You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on this episode, we are joined by Yume Balasingam Chow to talk about her debut novel, Names Have Been Changed, a story about a woman on a run from the law who starts a podcast to talk about her life and what has led her to this moment in the book. As always, Books and Boba is supported by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server. You can chat with us and other members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron's Choice book club pick. So as always, thanks to everyone who has joined us on Patreon, and we hope to see much more of you there in the future.
Yeah, so we talk with Yume about how she started writing short stories and transitioned into novel writing, what Singlish is and our ties to language and how that affects how we navigate the world. We talk about queerness. We talk about colorism. We talk about a lot of things. So I hope you guys enjoy this chat with Yume Balasingam Chow. We are here with Yume Balasingam Chow, who was born in Singapore and moved to Boston, where she teaches writing workshops at Grub Street. Her short fiction has received a Pushcart Prize special mention and has been shortlisted for the Commonwealth Prize. She has an MFA in creative writing from Boston University, and Names Haven't Changed is her debut novel. And we're going to be talking about that later in this episode. But welcome to the show, Yume.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we usually start our episodes with a little bit of an icebreaker. And, you know, I'm so excited to have you here because your book is formatted as if your main character is doing a confessional podcast episode. So I'm curious, like, are there any podcasts you regularly listen to?
Definitely. Just not in the last few months because I've been so busy. I listen a lot to Other People with Brad Listy. And also the Tin House podcast,
Between the Covers. The Tin House podcast.
Yeah, those are some of my favorites. But also I find myself often, like, you know, if I'm really interested in a writer, a lot of what I listen to are writing podcasts. Like if I've just read a book by a writer and I'm super excited, I'll go see what podcast interviews they've done because after reading the book, I want to hear more about the thinking process. And then that's how I find podcasts like yours and others that I'm like, oh, look at all the great interviews they have. And they're a huge treasure trove of resources for us. Yeah.
You know, I'm surprised that you don't like listen to true crime podcasts because your book is kind of like technically it's crime fiction, but not really. It's, you know, it's in that gray area of like it's fiction, but it's also, you know, there's mystery and there's crime involved.
Yeah. So true confession. I've never really been a true crime person. I don't really listen to the podcast. I've never listened to Serial. I've been told, I believe that it's excellent. I've never listened to it. And same with TV shows. Like, I don't really watch a lot of them. So I guess when the idea for this podcast came, I was really just reaching for something that seemed like the natural thing Ophia would do. And the main character, Ophia, and she's also not really someone who listens to podcasts or anything, but she's more like, okay, I've decided I'm going to speak my mind and live with it. So here goes. And she hits the button and just goes with it.
I mean, half the podcast in the world, maybe more than half the podcast in the world, is basically just that someone decides that they want to say something into the void. And then, you know, sometimes it just catches on.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about like when blogging started also, like, 20 years ago, people were just like, oh, I can make a blog for free and just say stuff. And then everybody was doing it, like, before monetization and all that kind of stuff. People were just, they had something to get off their chest and they did.
I miss the good old days of blogging when we just, you know, we're just putting personality tests and talking about, great. You know, what we ate for lunch.
I miss it too.
But yeah, welcome to the show. Congratulations on your debut. Something that we love doing on Books and Boba, you know, because we feature authors of Asian and Asian American descent, is just to, you know, get to know our authors. You know, there's so many different paths that people take to getting published, to writing their first novel, to, you know, becoming a writer. So can you share with us a little bit about your own personal journey and how you became a writer and then now a novelist?
Well, it's been a long journey. I started writing fiction maybe 15, 16 years ago, and mostly short stories. I thought I was writing a novel back then, but really I was just learning how to write. That draft of that novel has never been completed, and I won't go back to it because it's extremely messy. But it was a great way to learn how to write fiction and the mechanics of a novel. Before that, I had done various other jobs, and I still do other jobs. I mean, now I teach and I do editing work, and in past lives I've been a high school teacher. I've worked in media. I was a travel writer for a little while. So I've done all kinds of things. Yeah, so I guess writing short stories very slowly and working on novels. I have two novels that I didn't complete before names have been changed. And like people have been asking me, like, how long did it take you to write Names Have Been Changed? And my answer is always like, oh, you know, 3 to 4 years. But that's really fast by my standards. And before that, I have two incomplete novels. And I think the reason that I could write this one a little faster is because I had the practice of the first two and like learning novel mechanics, trial and error, struggling with characters and drama or lack of drama in some cases. And then over time, just like figuring out, oh yeah, this is how you do it. Or I think also getting to know myself better as a writer, knowing what kinds of stories I want to tell, how my sentences tend to run, what are good habits, what are bad habits, and all that kind of just, I don't know, growing over the years. And so the last 4 or 5 years that I spent on Names Have Been Changed, even though it did feel long in some ways, there were times when I was like trying to make a scene better or make a character pop a bit more, and I was like, oh, I know what to do. Like the solution came to me more quickly. Like it felt like I had more knowledge about my own writing at my own fingertips that I could draw on. Yeah,
a lot of authors, they have a novel, a manuscript in the drawer, and it never sees the light of day unless, you know, they decide to go back and like re-edit it and publish it later, which, you know, I've seen from some of our guests, on this podcast. So maybe it'll happen for you. Who knows? So I'm curious, because you were raised in Singapore and then you moved to Boston for what I'm guessing it was your master's. Like, what made you want to come here? And was writing something you were already doing in Singapore? Or was it something that you were like, okay, I think I want to change in pace? And then you decided after you decided to move here.
So I had been writing for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years in Singapore, fiction. And before that, I'd done some nonfiction writing. I was also doing research as a freelancer for history museums in Singapore and history exhibition projects. And I think I started out in some ways as a nonfiction writer first. Like there were some facts of history. There were lots of interviews that we did with people about social and cultural history of Singapore. And from that, we would assemble a storyline that became an exhibition, or in some cases, I helped with like a little short film that was shown in the exhibition. And so just ways of telling stories about quote unquote real life. And I think that kind of got me going as like, oh, okay, it's really fun to do this. Storytelling can work in so many ways to move the listener or the viewer. I wonder if I could do it with completely made up stuff. So then I shifted to kind of writing more fiction on my own. You know, not, it was something I did at night, on weekends, you know, exploring. And over time, just thinking like, you know, I really enjoy fiction much more than nonfiction. And this is the thing I really want to try and do. So, I had some artist residencies. I got to know, you know, various writers who were further along in the past who gave me really good advice. And long story short, I ended up coming to Boston to do my MFA at Boston University. And after that, I stayed on and tried to kind of maintain that orientation, I guess, towards fiction. I worked at a bookstore for 4 years while I was writing Names Have Been Changed. And that was another great way to sort of learn about publishing and learn about writing and also have access to so many wonderful books. I mean, I didn't read the ones in the store necessarily, but it was always like, oh, this book, I didn't even know it existed, came out 5 years ago, and I would, you know, learn more about it. Or to see what all the new exciting books were coming out. Yeah, and what people were excited to read.
I used to work at a bookstore as well, and I don't think people understand how many advanced copies show up at these bookstores. And it's like, oh my gosh, by the time when like the book comes out, like officially, there's just overflowing boxes of advanced copies. And you're like, we need to get rid of these. Would you like to be, are you interested in reading these? So that's how I would get a lot of my books. That's how I would get a lot of my reading done.
I still have advanced copies on that bookshelf back then from 5 years ago. I haven't read.
So, like, you started with short fiction, short stories, and that's so different from novel writing. Like, in the past, we've talked about how, like, novel writing is like a marathon, right? Sometimes you have to just grind through and get to the finish line. And then that's when you kind of realize what your book is about. Whereas with short stories, it's almost like you just take a scene. It's almost like screenwriting. You just take like a one specific part of like of a bigger story or a character. And I think it's a really good exercise for character development and also for like pacing, but it is a very different craft. So how was it transitioning from short story writing to novel writing?
I think in my case, I didn't really transition because I was, when I was a baby writer in fiction, I don't remember which, I feel like I simultaneously started dabbling in a few short story ideas as well as in the now lamented first novel attempt of like 15 years ago. So it was almost like I was trying to run before I knew how to walk. But I didn't realize that I was being foolish. I was just like, oh, I want to tell this story and it's going to be a novel. And then I would work on it. And at other times, I would go back to something that was clearly to me a short story idea because I was just interested in that moment in the character's life. And I would finish work on those short stories. So I was kind of doing both at the same time. I think what I learned was with short stories over time, learning how to manage a dramatic arc over a shorter distance. And also learning how to have characters do stuff like in a way that wasn't clunky on the page, finding ways to tell stories that maybe aren't so linear or not so literal. The short stories that I love are always like working on multiple levels, you know, and trying to think like, oh, I have this story idea. How can I make it richer and not just about the surface level plot? So I think I had a lot of fun doing both. And after I abandoned the first novel because I had a second novel that I tried, I was still writing short stories. And I think it was just making me better at crafting scenes, making connections between scenes. But I think, as you were saying, novel writing is a marathon. And it's also kind of, sometimes I say it's a beast. It's like this big thing that you have to kind of wrestle into enough coherence that the reader can follow you. And so I think that was probably something I learned trying to wrestle with the first two novels. Like even though their dramatic arcs were often clunky or awkward, over time, and from reading other books also, just reading more fiction and more different types of fiction, I like to read a lot of translated fiction because it also sort of sometimes challenges what my idea of a story is or what a quote-unquote satisfying resolution is. Yeah, for me, I think when coming to my own short stories, I was always interested in just that brief moment in the character's life and trying to present it as richly and as intriguing a way to the reader. And it reaches a nice ending, you know, the appropriate ending for that character. And you just kind of leave it there, kind of like, okay, I won't touch it again. I won't nudge it down further. I've had friends who ask me like, oh, that was a great short story. Won't you expand it into a book? A novel? And I would be like, no, I'm not interested in the character. I don't care what happens to them after the scene, like it's done. And then with the novel, kind of learning how to go on and on and on in some ways, like keep going deeper, write more scenes, I think what I had to learn was really to be less of a perfectionist with my first drafts of my novels. Because with a short story, you work at it and you work at it. And it's just like 5,000, 8,000 words. It's so much more manageable. Even if you rewrite, it's kind of like you're rewriting within a smaller confine. And with the novel, I tried to do that at first with scenes. And then I would have these so-called perfected scenes, but then they weren't actually linking up well or creating a proper structure, you know, a more complicated structure that the novel needs. And so I just had to learn to be like, you know what? It's time to learn to write the shitty first draft and let it
the zero draft, yeah.
Yeah. And learn to embrace that and let the ideas flow in as messy a way as possible. And then being like, okay, I'm going to go back now. Now that I have my first draft, I'm going to go back and make it better. Learning that, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's just like a good philosophy for life in general. Just like nothing has to be perfect the first time around. Like you can always go back and try again. And that's not a bad thing. So I'm glad that you're the way work through it. And now you have your novel out in the world. Names have been changed. Can you give our listeners maybe a brief synopsis of what your debut novel is all about?
Sure. Yeah. Names Have Been Changed is about a woman who calls herself Ophir and won't tell you her real name. She's from Singapore, where she has committed a crime, fled the country, and spent about 10 years roaming the world. And now she's decided to come clean on a podcast. And so the novel is, you know, episode by episode as she unfolds the story of what has happened to her since she left Singapore.
So I'm super curious, like what inspired you to frame your novel as podcast episodes? Because when we were pitched this book, I was like, oh my God, this is like so meta for us as podcasters, and reading a book that's in a podcast format, I'm like, that's not something that I've really seen before.
Yeah. So it started with the voice before the podcast. Before the podcast, there was the voice of Ophir, who started chattering away in my head one day. And as I started to write, you know, some sentences down, I was like, this character was emerging. It's more or less the first few pages of the novel. She's telling us, this is who I am. I stole some money. I ran away. I have deep regret, and now I'm going to tell you my story, she says. And after I'd written that first bit, I had to figure out, like, oh, why is she telling the story? Who is she telling the story to? And I landed on the idea of a podcast because it just seemed like the perfect vehicle for someone like Ophir, who is feeling this inner emotional pressure. She feels like she needs to tell someone her story now. She's been doing this for too long. She hasn't come clean. It's really bothering her. She's upset. She needs to spill it all out, but she really doesn't want to get caught at all either. She is not ready for that. And so the podcast seemed to offer that tension between, like, she can say whatever she wants and nobody knows where she is. And so I just ran with that from the first day. And I was like, okay, so I guess I just wrote part of episode one. Let's keep going with episode one. And then going on from there and thinking about, okay, how the different episodes would emerge and eventually, like, how having this podcast would change her in some way, like what would change by her telling her story in this very public way.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that, like, you know, now that podcasting has become an accepted form of media, you know, since the pandemic, which is, you know, your book is also a COVID book. It takes place during the lockdown, the 2020 lockdown, that, like, podcasts have now entered the realm of, like, epistolary, right? Now you have books. Your story basically takes the form of podcasting, and, you know, you commit to the bit, right? Every single chapter, every single episode starts with a preamble, a lead up to the story. You have tangents. You have segues. And I'm curious, did you listen to any podcasts as inspiration for Ophir's, like, voice, like her format?
No, I did not. Mostly because I thought of Ophir as someone who has been on the run and not really in some ways paying attention to trends on the internet and what people are doing. Like, she's too busy being like, okay, I've got to hide, I've got to have a job, I've got to have a roof over my head, and I don't want anyone to, you know, possibly even suspect I might be a criminal. So she doesn't, she kind of, social media has missed her in a lot of ways, and podcasts as well, because thinking about people who enjoy podcasts and come back week after week or month after month to hear the same voices or to hear the podcast host interview people and so on, like, there's a certain kind of commitment to that I think Ophir lacks. And so she has no model for it. She's just thinking, oh, this is a great technological solution to what I want to do. It seems effortless because she just turns on a mic and keeps talking. Like, she doesn't think about is this going to be interesting to the reader, to the listener? She just talks. She's like, I need to tell the story now. So here we go. Last week, I left you hanging in London. Now I'm going to continue. And she commits to that. Like, I told you I was going to tell you, so I'm going to tell you. But she doesn't think about how long it takes. She doesn't think about whether she needs a bathroom break and how she might get interrupted in other ways. Yeah.
Yeah. As a podcast producer, I definitely resonated with her producer, Tina, who has to take these ramblings and get them on the internet, do the background work to like upload everything. I did find it funny. So, you know, I mentioned that every episode starts with like a preamble leading up to, you know, the main mm-hmm. story of the chapter. And Ophir does comment on comments and things that are happening, like people reacting to her podcast as it becomes more and more popular as the book goes along. I'm curious, did you write out like those comments? Like, did you like have like a whole like a session kind of coming up with the public's reaction to each episode as you went along? Or is it all just like off the cuff?
Off the cuff. But I was thinking about it from the beginning. I was like, okay, the first episode, no one's going to know she's there because it's brand new. How long will something like this take to pick up momentum to the point where people will be tuning in and some of them might write back, which is what you're referring to when they actually send emails to express their views. And some of their views are, you know, kind and generous and forgiving, and other people are just saying terrible things about her because they can't believe that this runaway criminal is speaking her mind, you know, on the internet. I think I thought about it as a way of just like capturing the range of responses that we all get on the internet. It's a scary place. All kinds of people.
Reddit
you
is get the a warmest, scary place.
Yeah. Right? You get the warmest, most loving responses, and you also get batshit crazy, you know, off the wall. Like, why are you even bothering to write this email kind of response? So I did think about reflecting that because I didn't see her as being either a figure that would be well beloved or universally hated, that I think people would respond to different things in the way she told the story. Yeah, and I think I did want to bring the real world in as a sort of mini character. But at the same time, by the time these responses come in, it's about midway through the book. And Ophir has committed then to like keep telling her own story on her own terms, because she's also starting to feel the effect of, you know, getting all these issues and burdens out of her. And so she's like, you know, even if all of you stop listening tomorrow, I'm still going to tell my story. I'm going to do this for myself. You could say it's a selfish impulse at that point, but she's also like, you know, I know what's good for me, and what's good for me is telling this, not listening to all of you.
It's basically therapy at this point. Yeah.
Yeah. She's pretty adamant about that. Yeah.
Pretty much voice notes.
But she does like having an audience, I think. Yeah, it is voice notes. Like, she's not making voice notes. She does want the sense that maybe at least one person out there is listening to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
At least Tina's listening to her. So there's that Tina, her producer. I thought it was so clever for you to set the book during the pandemic, during the lockdown specifically, because Ophir is a character who's literally a fugitive, literally on the run. She has pretty much globetrotted because she doesn't want to get caught. And now she's forced to stay in one place for once. And I thought that was like a great way to, you know, kind of motivate her to start this podcast, because it's like, what, like, well, I can't run. I can't even do my, like, I can't, like, the world is at a complete stop. So what do I do? I guess I'll yap. And I just thought it was so interesting that you said like her voice came to you first rather than like the setting being like, okay, like it's set during the pandemic. What if my character starts a podcast? It's like, no, I came up with Ophir's voice first. So when did you realize, okay, I should set this during the COVID lockdown?
I started writing this, the voice came, and I started writing in March 2021. And so the lockdowns were just ended, you know, relatively still fresh in our memory. And also lockdowns were still going on in other parts of the world, you know, even though not in the US. So I think it was in the air in that sense. And yeah. I kind of plucked it and was like, let's use this, because it is, as you say, a handy way to just pin Ophir to one spot. She can't run at this moment. It was also a way to make her even more isolated than she is. Because all the while that she's been running around the world, she does have to work to support herself. So she does take on all these kinds of odd jobs and menial tasks, you know, things that nobody really wants to do. She is out and among people. Like, there's a chapter in the middle of the book where she's working in a Chinese restaurant in London. And she, every day she goes to work. She sees the manager of the restaurant. She sees all the customers. You know, she's among people. But she, nobody knows who she is. So in some way, she's still isolated. And then in the pandemic, she has a job because she still goes to it every day. But she doesn't really interact with people. And after work, there's nowhere else to go. She has to come home. And so that sense of feeling even more lonely at a loss, you know, like all of us were like, how long is this going to last? Are we really going to go back to everyday life after this? Everything's a little tentative. And then, I mean, at the beginning of the novel, she tells us that she has found out also during this time, the lockdown period, she was Googling her family and she found out, oh, her father has died, which completely knocks her. You know, she never expected that would happen while she was still runaway, you know, having not seen him all this while. So all that really throws her into a huge tizzy. And then we have the podcast.
Yeah. I also thought that it made so much sense that Ophir, in her previous life in Singapore, she was a voice actor. And, you know, she is doing this podcast not in her real voice. She is putting on kind of like an accent so that no one can really place where she is. And I thought that was like really clever as well, because in order to assimilate, especially for immigrants, for diasporas, you need to absorb the land's language and accent. And language reveals so much about our identity. It tells us where you're from, how educated you are. Like, if you're bilingual, there's going to be vocabulary that's slipping here and there. And can you talk about how you use language as a costume for Ophir, and just how her relationship with Singlish plays in with her running away?
Thanks for picking up all those things, because when I started writing the book at first, and I was like, okay, she's talking on a podcast, so basically she's just speaking live the whole time, I did have, you know, doubts at the back of my head, like, is anyone going to want to read this book where a character is just talking nonstop for several hundred pages? But I decided to just try it and see. And as I was working on it, yeah, all those points that you just made about language as a costume and something so intrinsic to our identity, wherever you are in the world, whatever language you speak, like all these sounds, it's like we use our body, our throat to make these sounds, and they're so intimate. So I thought that was really more, I didn't expect to explore it. And then I wound up finding ways that this was just kind of naturally emerging from Ophir's voice. And so she is someone who grew up in Singapore, talks about her natural voice, which would be with a Singaporean accent, and using Singlish, which is a Creole language in Singapore. And she's decided once she goes on the run that she can't do this anymore, because first of all, there are not that many Singaporeans in the world, she says. So it'd be too easy for someone to just be like, huh, you're from Singapore, aren't you? And that might sort of unravel her story. So she's very careful about not letting herself speak with her quote-unquote real voice. And I think over the 10 years, what happens is she doesn't realize that it's like really weighing on her, that this, it's like you're cutting off an essential part of yourself, you know, allowing yourself to inhabit it. It really does a number on you inside, I think. And so when she starts the podcast, I think she does speak in somewhat her natural voice, but she's also aware that the listeners, potentially a global audience, not a lot of people would understand Singlish, or if she spoke entirely in a Singaporean accent, they might not follow. And so she takes pain sometimes to just be like, okay, I'm going to speak in a relatively, so quote-unquote, neutral, you know, accent, so all of you can understand me. But once in a while, she'll make a reference to something in Singlish or a joke, and she may or may not explain it to the listener, depending on how she's feeling. Like sometimes she's like, ah, if you know, you know. And then other times she's like, oh, let me describe this thing because, you know, it really moves her. What was interesting was, like, there's, for instance, a moment when she's talking about the coffee uncle that she used to buy coffee from every day in Singapore. And she's thinking about him and she gets a little nostalgic and she says, ah, he used to always say, hot ah, don't burn your mouth. And she says the words in Singlish, because she's imitating him. But as she says it, it's like she softens a little and she feels like a shift inside her. And then she tells the listener, she's like, you know, usually I don't speak like that, but, you know, we understand each other, right? I can relax a bit here. And so that was really fun to play with throughout the novel, like moments when she's telling us about something really intense that happened and she gets very worked up again. And then other moments where it's a pleasant memory or, yeah, she can just kind of relax a bit and tell you something funny that happened, even though it may not be the heart of the story. And I think that was just an interesting way to explore different aspects of her voice in my head. Like, it's not a monotone. Anyone telling you their story, like, they go all over the place in terms of their mood.
Yeah. I mean, your novel follows Ophira. She bounces around the world while she's on the run. But I did find that the heart was all about Singapore, right? Whenever she talked, Singapore makes an appearance like every chapter, it's the heart of every like interaction she has, right? And specifically Singaporean culture, like underneath the squeaky clean facade that like the Singaporean government wants the world to like view Singapore as. So can you talk to us a little bit about like the Singapore that you wanted to show in your novel through Ophir?
Yeah. When I decided to send her around the world, at the very beginning, you know, in March 2021, I was like, okay, who's she going to meet? What's she going to do? And I decided it would be interesting for her to meet other Singaporeans, specifically Singapore women, who are also living in other parts of the world, different ages, different backgrounds that she's going to run into, get into relationships with, and to see what happened. And now that the novel is finished, I can kind of look back and realize, oh, I was writing a novel about diaspora without realizing it. And these women that Ophir meets, they've left Singapore for lots of different reasons. One is a university student. You know, she's in her 20s. She's ready to explore the world. Someone else is a political exile. Someone else is an older woman who has moved abroad to join her daughter overseas. Even though she doesn't know anyone in Colorado, she moves to Colorado to join her daughter. And I just found all those ways of relating between the place you immigrate to and the place that you're from. And one thing, I guess, wonderful about the 21st century is that for a lot of us who move around the world, including myself, like we have so much technology at our disposal that you can keep in touch with what's going on at home. And you're definitely not as cut off from it as people in earlier generations. And so a lot of people, I think, now have the opportunity, like you move to a new place, you build a new life there, but you're also kind of regularly glancing over your shoulder and it's like, hey, what's going on at home? Or like, how are my family and friends at home doing? Maybe people even move back and forth between various countries, you know, like so many different types of mobility. And I wanted to write a bit about that. Singapore is a very small country. I mean, like the population is like, I don't know, the latest 5-6 million. And some people never leave the island, but some people also move abroad for work, for study. Some come home, some don't. And I think exploring identity through that, because sometimes you don't really have to consider your own identity until you move somewhere else where people are like, oh, so you're from Singapore. What's that like? And then suddenly you have to define the thing you've taken for granted your whole life. Or in Ophir's case, when she's cut off from it, the memories she has of it become all the more precious because she can't have them anymore.
Yeah, I definitely picked up on diaspora as like a central theme of your book as well. You know, Ophir goes to, you know, the main stops, London, Tokyo, and the US, all countries with diaspora communities. The diaspora communities are the communities that she finds refuge in as well as she's on the run. And in a lot of ways, Singapore itself is also a diaspora nation, a nation of diaspora, right? And that's what allows her to gather all of these languages, all of these like accents that she can use to, you know, to remain hidden. And so I think you definitely captured those themes really, really well.
Oh, thanks. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, I think in Singapore, like just for myself growing up there, you grew up with a lot of languages around you and many different kinds of food and religions and cultural practices. And you recognize that there are many different ways to live, right? Different cultures, practices and so on that one can follow. And also many different sounds. As a child, I think I was always interested in, like, it was in my family, various people speak different languages. I don't speak that many. I only speak English and Mandarin. Little bit of Cantonese, that's it. But there are other languages that I recognize by sound, even though I can't speak them. And I think living in a multilingual environment, you just get attuned to it. Like now when I travel, or even here in Boston, if I'm just on the bus, sometimes I hear something, I'm like, oh, what's that person speaking? I'm trying to identify it, even though I don't speak the language, because I'm just curious about the sounds.
Yeah, and I think like in a country like Singapore, where a lot of people speak multiple different languages, also like your relationship with each language is going to be different. Like, for example, in the later chapters, Ophir is in America because she is becoming like this caretaker assistant for a dementia patient. And that dementia patient can only speak in Malay. And Ophir is like, I only talked in Malay with my grandmother. And my grandmother has passed away, and like, it's like she reverts back to this little mm-hmm. girl when she is speaking that language. And I was just thinking about how, like, that is so true for a lot of diasporans. And when we mm-hmm. talk in our mother tongue or like a second or third language that our family member speaks, it's like, okay, it's kind of like a time capsule. Because even then, sometimes the language has evolved. Like, some people yes. don't talk the same way as the current dialect in the motherland. So I thought that was really interesting as well, because it seems like in every country that Ophir goes to, there's just kind of this preconception of like what language she'll speak. And she uses that to her advantage, because obviously she is mixed race and she has a darker skin tone than a lot of East Asians. And there's a line in the book that just like made me laugh, where she was just like, imagine who is like at the very bottom of your social class, and that's where they will put me. And because of that, she's just able to kind of shift identities and shift along with like the language that she speaks. So I thought that was very interesting. How did you map out what countries and neighborhoods she would travel to? Because obviously, as a fugitive, the world is your oyster. I mean, obviously, you need to have money and fake passports. But how did you figure out like where she would go and how she would survive?
Well, I was thinking of places where she could blend in easily, because I didn't see her running off to a tiny village somewhere where she would stick out as the only outsider. So the instinct seemed to be to go for bigger cities at least. And I landed on Tokyo and London and Colorado, because they're places that I visited before. And in London, I lived there for a year. And I did this because I didn't want to go down a rabbit hole of too much research, because I knew that was my Achilles heel. I love doing research. And research, as I found out with my previous incomplete novel projects, research is an excellent way to procrastinate on the writing. And so for this one, I really told myself, okay, I'm just going to put her in these big cities that I kind of know a little bit about. And I don't need to become an expert in them, because Ophir's not an expert. She's an outsider. She goes there. She gets a couple of jobs to just get by. She sticks to her little corners, you know, the little neighborhoods that she lands up in. She's not trying to get attention, and she's not trying to like plant herself, you know, at all the tourist hotspots or anything like that. So that worked out rather well in terms of just dropping her into these little corners of the world and seeing who she would meet there. And then with language, that because she was previously a voice actor, it seemed to make sense that she would think about how she could mask her voice and adopt different accents and personalities to go with it. I think one thing she didn't expect, Ophir didn't expect, was that by not allowing herself to speak in a Singaporean accent or to use Singlish, that all the more it would have this emotional pull on her. And so there's a point in the novel where she says, quite early on, I think, she says, oh, every time I heard the sound of a Singapore accent or Singlish, it was like a spell. It transforms her into her true self. And that happens over and over again. It's almost like her. Yeah, it's her Achilles heel. When she meets, thinking about in Tokyo, she was working at a hostess bar, and another woman comes up to help her get dressed, you know, for the evening. And the other woman says, can I help you with the zipper? And it's a perfectly good sentence in English, but the way it's said with the sort of Singaporean intonation, immediately Ophir is like, oh, this woman is from Singapore. Okay, I'm both She both wants to hear the accent more, but she's also afraid of being found out. And so she has this push and pull, you know, in the relationship with this woman who becomes her friend and more in the story. So I think that that push and pull of sound and Ophir's sensitivity to it, using it to her advantage, but it's other times that it kind of surprises her. You were talking earlier about the woman in Colorado that she ends up being like a translator and sort of caregiver assistant for. And when she agrees to work for this family, she's just like, oh, this is easy money. I speak enough Malay to get by. These two, you know, the mother and daughter in this household seem pretty harmless. I'm probably safe here. But she doesn't expect that being around the two of them, hearing the sounds of Malay, which Ophir hasn't really heard since she was a child, and then even the food in the house, some of the cultural objects remind her of her grandmother. And so that moves her much more deep. She's actually very vulnerable in that house in a way that she never expected to be. She couldn't have calculated it. And that was an interesting transformation to watch her go through.
Yeah, I would say like Singlish and Malay to a certain extent, it's like a siren's call, you know, like she just can't help but, you know, lean in and be like, oh, like, are they from Singapore? Because, you know, she's cut that part off of her. And, you know, it's a phantom pain. And I really thought that, you know, she not only does she yearn for Singlish, she also yearns for someone to call her by her real name. And she goes by a lot of different names. Like, we know her as Ophir in this podcast, but it's not her real name. She also went by Hui Ying, Anna Maria, Haley, Nora, many more aliases. And obviously she has to change her alias multiple times because she is a fugitive. What did you want to explore when it came to the significance of names?
Names are something so easy to take for granted until something changes in your life, and either you have to change your name or you want to change your name, and then you start thinking quite seriously, oh, who do I want to be? If it's a voluntary choice, hopefully it's a pleasant choice and a person lands on a name that they really enjoy. But in Ophir's case, you know, she kind of had to give up her name. She didn't want to. And it's so precious that she doesn't even want to say it to us. She just wants someone who knows how to call it. There's a few times in the novel when a family member, or like in London, she runs into an old school friend who calls her by her name. And Ophir tells us that they called her by her name, but Ophir won't give us the name because it's not for the listener to know. It's for someone who actually does know her to know the name. As for her aliases, I mean, for someone running around the world, it's kind of, you kind of have to do this. It's also a little bit fun because I think all of us, you know, since we were kids, enjoy play acting, imagining ourselves adopting some other identity. It seems cool to change your name. If when you were growing up, you didn't really like your name, you could always imagine yourself having another name and an alternative life. Then, except in Ophir's case, it starts to weigh on her. Like, she realizes, like, all these names don't mean anything. It's just something to get me to the next spot and keep me safe. I think what's interesting in the book also, which I didn't intend at the beginning, but, you know, now I can look back and see the pattern that emerged, was that a lot of the other characters also don't know their real names. The woman in the hostess bar who becomes Ophir's friend, she's always referred to by her stage name at the bar, which is Gigi. It's not her real name. There is a political exile in the novel that Ophir refers to as the doctor. And so, again, never learn her name. And I think it was interesting to think about situations where people don't use their real names, either to protect themselves or for other reasons. And how much we do need, like, yeah, how much do we need to know a person's name? And how much do we know of them as a character if they show who they are by how they behave? Or in Ophir's case, like when I was writing it, as I said, the voice came to me at the beginning. Over the first few months, as I kind of got to know this voice, I was like, oh, this is it. Okay, this is the part. These are the impulses of this character. I almost didn't even need to make up a real name for her. I mean, I know what her real name is. I'm not going to say it. But I almost was like, I don't need to actually mention it because I know who she is. And if I put this on paper, hopefully, like, the reader will also feel it. And It's like you end the novel not knowing her name, but you almost don't need to. You already know who she is and why she did.
Yeah, Ophir's voice is really interesting through the podcast form. She is someone who is reflecting on her earlier days. And I thought she was an interesting character because she makes bad decisions, like a ton of bad decisions throughout the book, but she's also the victim of circumstances, of like things happening beyond her control. And, you know, throughout the novel, she's looking back at all the bad decisions she's made with, like, you know, we've all looked back at our youth, you know, and thought about how, like, man, I really shouldn't have done that. That was not the right move. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, creating her character and her arc, and then creating that voice of like someone who is like in a more, maybe not better place, but a more mature place, looking back at all their youthful indiscretions?
Yeah. So Ophir is someone who grew up, you know, in a comfortable home, youngest of six children. Her father provided well for them. You know, she had a grandmother looking after her until she was eight, and then her grandmother passed away. And so she seemed like a very ordinary person who then later gets drawn into extraordinary circumstances almost by accident. And almost by accident because even when she gets involved in crime, basically her best friend, Nirmala, pulls her into a scheme and they become money mules. Ophir's rationale at that point is like, well, this is easy money. Seems good. Let's just go with it. And I do think that often in everyday life, you know, sometimes we make these little decisions that are impulsive without thinking too much about the consequences because it seems, you know, a small thing. And then the longer you get mixed up in it, you know, the more potentially dire the consequences get. So I found that fascinating and also very human, I think. And I wanted to see what a person like that, you know, what they would do next. I would never make a choice like that because I'm too terrified of consequences. But I liked thinking about a character who maybe tends to act first and sometimes, you know, later on, as you say, then reflect and go, oops, maybe shouldn't have done that. Even on the day that Ophir leaves Singapore, the police are basically catching up with her and she's panicking. And so she's like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. That's what I'm going to do. She doesn't really think about what that consequence will be. She goes to the ATM, grabs some money, goes home, grabs a bag, is running out the door, bumps into her brother. He offers to help her get a cab. She's like, I'm good. She keeps running. And it's not really till she's well beyond Singapore's borders that she realizes what she's done and gotten herself basically into more trouble. Like, not only is she wanted for the crime that she committed, now she's also an international fugitive. Much, much worse.
I thought it was pretty funny how later on in the chapter, she was like, yeah, so my best friend who wrote me into this scheme, she's out of prison now. She, like, you know, she did her time 3 years and now she bakes cakes and trying to like live a normal life. And I'm like, 3 years versus the 10 years that she's been running. I mean, it makes you question as a reader. You're like, are you like, what kind of freedom are you going after? Like, why are you so desperate? And, you know, I couldn't help but think it tied to her queerness because it's said, like, it's mentioned a couple times that even though there are queer people in Singapore, there's always like this pressure to, you know, mask it or to not let the elders know. And it seemed to me as a reader that, like, by leaving Singapore, she did have more freedom to be outwardly queer. And also you have other characters who are queer Singaporeans, like Florissa in London, who is Ophir's like old classmate. She's kind of new to her queer identity. And I thought it was a really good contrast to Ophir and her history with being openly queer. So why was it important for you to show that spectrum of queer visibility amongst your Singaporean characters?
Yeah, Ophir from the beginning was someone who was impulsive, as I said, and also enjoys pleasure. And so she's not very politically minded or identity conscious, but she's just kind of like, oh, that person looks good. Let's see if we can sleep together. It's basically her train of thought. And it was something she was doing already in Singapore. And then when she goes abroad and is on the run, she continues to behave, to you know, to live as she wishes, as long as she feels that no one is going to realize that she's a criminal and turn her in. As long as she feels like that line is not crossed, she can do, you know, she can enjoy life a little. Yeah, with the other characters, I was also thinking about, like, people who feel straitjacketed in some way in Singapore. Because one downside of coming from a very small society in terms of, you know, the number of people and so, and the actual size of Singapore is small, is that there's a strong sense of, like, social norms and how everyone ought to behave. And a lot of them are heteronormative and not really questioned even today. I mean, like, they are being questioned, but they're not being changed. And so thinking about characters who go abroad because maybe they might go looking for more opportunities and freedom to express themselves, not just sexually, but in other ways as well. Or they might actually stumble across it. They go abroad to study or to work, and then they realize, oh, there are many different ways that I could live my life here, including expressing, you know, being queer, being one of them. But at the same time, I did also want to have queer characters in Singapore who have made a life for themselves. And one of them is Ophir's brother, whom you hear about off and on while she's on the run. And he's someone who has found a way to live his life, you know, as a gay man in Singapore, despite the restrictions and, yeah, impositions on him. Yeah. So I think the idea was to show range. It's kind of like with the diasporic women characters. Like, there are many different reasons why people leave. And acknowledging that that diversity was important to me, I was really trying to move away from, like, one way of looking at Singapore or one way of looking at home or identity.
We are kind of winding down to the end of our time, and it kind of flew by. So I just want to ask, like, this book probably has an audiobook. Marvin and I only read it, like, with the physical copy, but I can only imagine, like, how much more immersive an audiobook would be and how, like, how much of a demand it will require for the audiobook narrator, because they have to have so many accents and get, like, nail the dialects. And I'm just wondering, like, were you involved at all in the process of, like, finding the right voice actor to narrate the audiobook?
Yeah. Once, it was really important to me to get the voice right. And I knew it would be a challenge. And so long before my publisher, so Penguin Random House Audio did the audiobook, and the process didn't start until close to publication, a couple of months ago. But long before that, I was like, oh my goodness, who are the possible voices? And I went around talking to friends who are in drama and other backgrounds where they might come across people. And I think the good news is that there are actually quite a number of women, at least, with some background familiarity with Singapore and Malaysia, and able to speak with different accents and so on. And so when the time came a couple of months ago, when the audiobook production began, I passed along some names that I had come across, and the producer, who was fabulous, also came up with other names. And so when the audition clips were ready, she sent them to me to listen. We had a discussion, and we ended up picking a narrator who has some background in Singapore, Malay. I don't want to get into, like, personal life of the narrator, but basically was comfortable doing some of the accents, the Singlish and so on. But more than that, I think during the production process, when I wasn't involved in recording or anything, but I would get occasional email updates, and they were checking in on pronunciations very carefully, and they were being really thoughtful about it. Not just the words that are Singlish or Malay or other languages, but also sometimes even the pronunciation of a word that varies between an American or a British English pronunciation, and just saying, like, okay, in this scene, which one do you think Ophir would say? And I was like, oh my goodness, let me think about that, because, yeah. And then, so I really appreciated the care they took to it. And I think they are trying to create that immersive experience so that someone who listens to it will feel like, yeah, this could be Ophir. doing all her voices. And yeah, this does sound like someone who at least grew up in Singapore. Yeah. I haven't actually listened to the audiobook yet. I am excited to listen to it once I sit down and like focus. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, both your novel and the audiobook, accompanying audiobook, will be out by the time listeners listen to this episode. I'm sure you're busy with all sorts of book launch things. I kind of hate asking this question, especially to someone who just released a book. But like, are you working on anything else down the pipe?
Of course, you have to. Yes, I am writing a new novel because I love writing. And I can't wait to be writing more things. I started writing something new last year. I've always got a couple of projects sort of in the air, like incomplete short stories and other things. But at the moment, I am trying to push ahead with the first draft of a new novel. I'm not really saying what it's about yet, but it's exciting. And it's completely unrelated to Names Have Been Changed. So it feels like a new adventure, like a new bunch of characters, learning how to write these characters well and, you know, give them things to do that will be interesting. And I often tell myself, you know, every day that you work on the novel, as long as I myself learn something new about the project, that's good enough. Whether I write 10 words or 100 or 1,000 words, as long as I learn something new, this is a great discovery. Yeah, love it.
That's such a great positive mindset. Like, as someone who also writes, I'm like, I am the most negative person ever. So I should really, you know, I should really take up your mindset when it comes to writing new stuff. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Yume. I'm really excited to, you know, get the audiobook and listen to this book, experience it in another way, because, my God, I loved it. You know, congratulations on your debut novel again. And we wish you the best with your future projects.
Thank you both so much. It was great to talk to you. And yeah, Ophir, thanks you as well for listening.
Thanks. And that was Yume Balasingam Chow. Her debut novel, Names Have Been Changed, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, a Books and Bubble online bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation with Yume and are interested in picking up her book, head on over to booksandbubble.com and check out our bookshop link. As always, all purchases made on our online bookstores support not only us here at Books and Bubble, but also your local bookstore. So we really appreciate everyone who has bought a book from us so far. All right, well, before we go, we still have a few days left in the month of June. So Rira, can you remind us what book we are reading this month for Book Club?
So we are reading Nevo's debut novel, The Chosen and the Beautiful, which is a reinvention of the classical Great Gatsby novel, but it's filled with magic, mystery, and of course, glittering excess of the 1920s.
Yeah, so we will be recording our discussion of this book pretty soon. So if you finish the book and want to let us know some of your thoughts, you can let us know now on Discord or on Goodreads. As always, we'd love to include your feedback in our discussion episode whenever possible. But yeah, with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Bubble. Thank you once again to Yume Balasingam Chow for joining us, and we will see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone. especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, I'm Bill Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.